Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Larry Mueller here. Time to take a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. Great to have her along. Thank you for listening in. Surveys show that more than half of our cats and dogs are overweight. Maybe your pet is one of them, and maybe you don't even realize it. We'll talk with Dr. Sandy about that and, of course, answer your questions relating to weight of your pet and other health questions as well. Call in at 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And Dr. Sandy, welcome back.
It is so nice to be here today.
You know, Tiger was overweight and probably still is a little, but I really had to go to carefully measuring out the amount of food that he was getting.
And that's probably one of the big concerns that we have is, especially with cats, it's so easy to just free feed them because their natural eating behavior is to eat, like on average, about a dozen little meals a day. And so, you know, if you don't want to be there just dishing out small amounts, you may have a cat that starts bothering you all the time, please feed me, even though they've probably had everything they need calorically for the day. So that's why there's some like new things coming out, different feeding methods that are interactive for cats, that are toys that you can put food in and then hide them around the house so the cat has to hunt for them and actually get some exercise and things. Works well for one cat because I know in my house I'd have one hunting and one just sitting there and watching and probably not getting anything. But that's the dilemma is how many people that have cats just have one cat and we have to feed them as individuals rather than as a group.
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. What about dogs?
Same thing. But I think some of the big issues that we have with dogs is kind of twofold. One is the types of breeds that are now kind of raising in popularity, what we call the brachycephalic breeds, the bulldogs, the shih tzus, pugs, and so on, that have respiratory problems and have difficulty exercising anyways. And so they don't need as many calories because they're not getting the exercise that they need. But there's so many foods out there that are high calorie, high fat foods, very palatable, and owners aren't using measuring cups, or if they are overdoing how much they're feeding. And I have to ask, it's amazing how to weed out every calorie that dog's getting. I've had owners keep diaries. I've had to sit down and develop a question list that includes things like, well, what liquids does your dog get? Because people don't seem to think that, you know, drinking that milk from the cereal bowl is going to add calories. But it does when you're dealing with a little dog. What gravies or sauces do you add to your pet's food? Or what treats do you give your dog? People don't think that things like rawhide, which is a chew thing that dogs can get, is high in calories. But those, like just those little flip chip type things that are a little piece of square rawhide can have 60 to 100 calories. And that could be for a small dog, a quarter of their calories a day. So, you know, it's all those kind of hidden things that we try to find out. And so when we're asking, we're doing it for the health of the pet to try to have them live longer, have less arthritis problems, less risk of diabetes, less secondary skin problems because you've got skin-on-skin contact. And, you know, all the health problems, even cancer has been associated, some forms of cancer, with increased weight. So we want your pets to live a long, healthy life, and we're not trying to deprive them. We're just trying to, you know, have them have a happy life that's healthy.
Cheryl in Conover has something I think it relates to this. Let's go there. Cheryl, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning. I can't believe I'm the first caller. Anyway, Dr. Sandy, we have four dogs, two boxer rescues, a golden lab, a shepherd rescue, and then, of course, a golden retriever in our family, and that's just the dogs, not the cats.
But okay.
In essence, Molly Golly, our mixture of shepherd, lab, golden, something. We call her the roly-poly dog.
And how did I guess? I was thinking that that's got to be the dog. You're going down the list, and I was like, that's going to be the dog that has the weight problem. Yeah.
Well, and here's the deal. We go to vets in Wisconsin, and we go to vets in Texas, and our best friend is a vet out of Cornell. And we have done everything, but she just stays this roly-poly dog. We measure our food, It is one cup for each dog in the morning and one cup in the science diet measuring container in the evening. They do not get table scraps, with the exception every once in a while when the family is up having bacon for breakfast. We might put a teaspoon in their food, but not with regularity at all. She runs. She plays. She loves to chase chipmunks. She is never out of breath. It's just like she's like a body that belongs maybe on taller legs
or something. Well, you know, what's going on here,
well,
Sandy?
There, it very well could be genetic. We see, I mean, when I look at all the charts and everything that we use for determining body condition scores on pets. And what I mean by that is we critically assess the dog from head to toe when we're doing our physical to try to come up with kind of and again, it can be fairly subjective, a number to say how fit is your dog from in body condition score. And a 4 to 5 out of 9 is considered slender to normal body condition score. 1 is the walking skeleton, and 9 is on the very opposite end. And the dog that they inevitably use in all of those posters and things that are published are Labrador Retrievers. And so there has to be some genetic predisposition for it to have so many labs be overrepresented. They either really like their food or have a lower metabolism and we know that spaying and neutering, although that doesn't make them fat, it does lower their metabolism, which lowers the amount of calories that they need to have on board. And spaying is definitely has more effect on the body than neutering. So we tend to see a lot of overweight female dogs. So it may be genetics. It may be that even with you measuring the food, she may still be getting too many calories, and you may need to look at where those calories are coming from. Sometimes we have to change the diet to be a diet that may be a low fat, low carbohydrate, high protein diet, kind of like an Atkins diet for people. And there are foods like that that are available out there to help with weight loss. But they typically are therapeutic or prescription diets that you have to get from your veterinarian. So it may mean that she may need a different type of food. So her calories are coming from different places, which may help boost her metabolism if she's taking in more protein, which is going to support lean body tissue rather than the fat tissue. So that would be one place to be looking at it. Then I'd also be looking at other hidden areas that she may be getting it. I mentioned rawhide, dental chews, that kind of thing. Okay.
Stealing food.
Yeah. Stealing food from the other dogs, stealing food from the cat.
Cats are separated. No.
All right. Yeah.
One thing we do, we have a kennel. We kennel our dogs. They're crate trained dogs. And when we sleep at night, we say kennel up, and we give them a half of a medium dog biscuit, which is the dog biscuits that are dry, and they are used for like small to medium dogs, and our dogs are bigger dogs.
And those have about 30 to 60 calories, depending on the brand.
Yeah, and we do that maybe twice a day, so maybe she gets one whole one a day.
Okay.
Maybe.
Okay.
And that's for sure every day. One whole one a day, and that's it. But
that's 900 calories a month.
Yeah, that could be. Yeah. And all it takes is 3,000 extra calories to gain a pound of fat. So, it doesn't take much. But those are the kind of things that when we're figuring out, this is what she's taking in, and we know exactly how much she's getting in. And it may be below our calculated number. And, yes, we have charts and formulas and things that we use, but we have to look at each animal as an individual. So if we are sure that that's all they're getting, that there's no other chance that they're sneaking other things in, like stealing that loaf of bread off the counter or whatever it may be, then we lower the caloric amount that they're taking in, but making sure that they're getting enough of the nutrients. And that's where switching over to a therapeutic weight-reducing diet is going to provide your dog with all the nutrients it needs, but have lower calorie intake. And so they may be able to eat the same volume, but actually getting a lower amount of calories going in. So this would be, again, it's not an easy thing when you've got a group of dogs. And everybody that I know of, including me, likes to have one brand of dog food to feed everybody. But that doesn't work for every household. So I think it's time to go back to your veterinarian, get a body condition scoring done, have them calculate out how many calories she needs to get back to her ideal body weight, look at what you're actually feeding, bring your measuring cup in, you know, the name of the dog food that you're using, the biscuits that you're using, so that we can do a total, this is what you're getting a day, and then we can reduce it from there or change to something else that's going to be a little bit lower in calories. Don't give up. It's always possible, because we don't want her to rupture cruciates or, you know, have increased risk of arthritis down the road. It sounds like she's a really fun dog and enjoys life, and we want her to be able to have lots of life, and we do know that they live about 13% longer than dogs that are, or shorter, I should say, than dogs that are normal weight.
And what would you estimate in terms of, let's say she changes the diet to your recommendation?
We only recommend that they lose about 1% of the weight that they need to lose per week. So it's a very slow, gradual weight loss. And it can take several months to get down to that point. And so when you're talking about, you know, a smaller dog or a cat, it's barely noticeable, but we do see it on the scale. And so having frequent weigh-ins that with an accurate scale is really helpful to let you know that you're right on track.
Good luck, Cheryl. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. So she's got a little work ahead of her.
You know,
there.
And it may be the kind of exercise this dog needs. There are some dogs that I swear they need to run 5 miles a day. They need to have a flock of sheep that they can herd. If they don't have that, even though they may be in a fenced yard and playing, it may not be the type of exercise that they need to be able to burn those calories. So working with a physical therapist or somebody that maybe can come up with swimming exercises or other things that you may be able to do would help this dog to get some of those extra calories burned up too.
And you can see, or she can see, that the dog is overweight, but how do you tell if your dog is, or your cat is overweight?
That's all those things that we look at. We feel over the rib cage, and I tell people one of the easiest ways to know what a normal rib should feel is to make a fist. And so I'm making a fist right now on the radio. If you feel over where your knuckles are, that is too thin. If you feel over where the back of your hand is and what that feels like, that's too fat. If it's over where your fingers are, that's just right. Okay, so just enough coverage that you can feel that. But any dog, even a morbidly overweight dog, if you push hard enough, you can find rib tissue. I mean, they're there. And I've had people say, see, I can feel the ribs. Well, yeah, but you're pushing. You just want to feel very carefully. We also look over the tail head. Sometimes dogs will get a big dimple there because they get kind of a big fat roll over their back end. We'll see fat pads over the kidney area, up over their back. Some dogs distribute their fat over their chest, and so we palpate the neck area. We look at the waistline. We want to see a waist from above and a waist from below. For male dogs, they'll often develop a big fat pad between the abdominal wall and the penis, and so everything starts to droop a little bit, and that's an area that we can feel as well. So it's very subjective, but I think that this is something that we do on every patient that comes in for every appointment, is do a nutrition and weight assessment.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, our guest from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer today here on the Ideas Network. Coming up at 2 o'clock today, Kathleen Dunn will talk with the author of a new book about Winston Churchill. Right now, taking a look at your pet's health with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk. And all our lines are filled right now. The number is 1-800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org. Speaking of email, Muriel in Spring Green emailed to say that the best thing they did for their overweight cat was to get an automatic feeder set at 4 small feedings a day. They also moved it downstairs, so the cat had to take the stairs four times a day.
Wonderful. What a great way to exercise that cat, making them go up and down rather than just like, hey, feed me, and they just have to walk a couple of steps to the food bowl. That is wonderful. And sometimes we have to be inventive with coming up with ways to get our pet to exercise, and especially with cats. If they're overweight, they're just going to lay there on the floor and bat at that feather toy that you're waving in front of them. So she found a way to do that. And I bet the cat doesn't bother them either, because it sits and waits for that door to open up and have that food be available to them.
And we have a photo on our Facebook page, the Facebook page titled The Larry Mueller Show, of an overweight cat. And they look cute. But...
Oh, yeah. And that's the problem, is people look at this and it's almost like recognized as the norm. And it isn't. Now, that cat, just looking at it, I would say is well above a 9 out of 9 body condition score. That's a kitty ottoman with legs. Okay, so... And I bet that cat can't groom itself. And sometimes the convincing factors are when I tell the owner, guess what you're going to have to do? Every time your cat goes and uses the litter box, you have to be there to wipe their bottom because they're getting skin irritation because they can't groom. And they're like, really? You know? Or the cat becomes a diabetic and now they're twice a day having to give this cat insulin, which can be bothersome, and you know, it's easy to do, but it's still, you're on the cat's medication schedule, and taking vacations could be hard. It's all kinds of things to consider. So yeah, that's not what we want our cats to look like.
If you'd like to see that, go to our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Or if you've got a photo, we always love photos, pet photos.
Even if your pet is overweight, you know, maybe they've lost some weight and this is kind of an interim picture. We want to see it.
Yes. So post that up on The Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Jeff in Grand Marsh, thanks for calling. Hello.
Good morning. I'm curious. Back when I was a kid and even a few years ago, we had dogs with long hair that stayed outside all the time, even during the winter. And I don't recall them shedding anything like our house dogs do now.
Well, they were outside in the wind.
Yeah.
And so they probably still shed, but some of it is breed related. It may be temperature and season related as well. Sometimes dogs, as they age, will have abnormal or excessive shedding as well. So there's a lot of factors there that go into shedding. But when dogs are inside, you're going to see more of the hair because it's there. It doesn't have any place to blow around or go to. So it's going to be a more of a problem for you. So I don't think it has anything to do with whether they're indoor or outdoor. It's just the circumstances that they're living in. So get a good brush, get a good vacuum cleaner. Yeah.
There you go. Thanks, Jeff, for calling. Appreciate it. Rick and Hurley, your turn. Hi, Rick.
Good morning. I'm looking for a little guidance. I've got a 9-week-old yellow lab male, and he eats like a pig. And I don't know what the rule of thumb is for how much you're supposed to feed these puppies. I haven't had one for a while. I feed them a cup in the morning and a cup in the evening. And he acts like he's starving. He's looking for more, so...
Yeah.
What's the rule of thumb for feeding them?
Well, that's a 9-week-old puppy. I usually recommend 3 meals a day. They tend to get hungry they're a little bit older, till they're 12 to 16 weeks, then you can start cutting down to twice a day. Some dogs, we can do what I call free choice meal feeding, meaning you put down more food than they can eat, you give them 15, 20 minutes with it, they eat what they like, and then you put the rest away. But there are dogs like your dog that we cannot do that with, where they are unable to self-regulate and meet their own needs, and they'll just eat everything in sight. So then you have to go by, how does your dog look? You know, are they growing normally? Do they have, enough muscle tissue, or can you see ribs a little bit too easily, meaning that they're a little too thin? You can go by what's the guidelines that are on the bag, but obviously those are just very vague guidelines. There are dogs that don't need as much, and there are dogs that need a whole lot more to be able to meet their growth needs. There are formulas that we can use to figure out, here's what your dog weighs, here's how much they should, many calories they should be getting a day. But that's going to change on a day-by-day basis with these guys. So I think if your dog is acting hungry, I mean, for a lab puppy, 2 cups a day, regardless of the caloric content of the food, does not sound like enough. So you may want to go up to 3 cups a day, monitor how your dog is doing. If they're starting to get a little extra weight on them that they don't need, then obviously you need to cut back a little bit and maybe go back to twice a day feedings. But it's just going to be one of those week by week, very critically monitoring your dog. And I don't think you're going to have a dog that is able to self-regulate, unfortunately. Yeah.
No, he won't. He went downstairs and tried to chew through the dog bag.
Oh, my goodness. Yeah. So we have that in a closet. Yeah.
Oh, he's a total pig. I got on the scale with him last week, and he weighs 15 pounds, so I don't know if that's out of the realm of, you know, what he should weigh.
Well, that sounds like about average for a puppy that's 9 weeks old in, you know, a large breed puppy. But you have to look at what size the parents were. I kind of go too by what was the breeder feeding them before you adopted the dog. Unfortunately, a lot of breeders will, instead of individually feeding the puppies, they put one big bowl of food down and just say, have at it. And that's kind of the way I was raised when I was a kid. Mm-hmm. It was like, okay, you know, everybody eats as fast as you can because whoever finished first got first pick a dessert. And so it taught me to eat fast, crave sweets, and know how to measure angles and math for pieces of pie and cake and so on. And that's the same thing with these little guys. I mean, they just learn that if they don't elbow their way in there and eat as fast as they can, they're going to starve because somebody else is going to eat it. And they don't forget that when they're in their new home and they don't have anybody else eating their food. So they may continue to, you know, gorge like that, even though it's not necessary. So, you're probably the rest of your life are going to have a dog that you're going to need to be really careful with, that you're watching their body condition score.
There you go.
So do you think then if I gave them a cup and a half 2 times a day or a cup 3 times a day?
I would go with a cup. I would start out with a cup 3 times a day. That would be my starting point, is 3 times a day, because I think the dog's probably going to be very hungry between meals, which may be encouraging them to eat faster when they are finally fed.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Mary Rose in Westfield, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. I was just wondering, is there a procedure to clean and possibly extractions of dogs' teeth without putting dogs under
anesthesia? No. I mean, there is really, as soon as you said extractions, I'm like, what? No. I mean, that is it can be a very painful procedure, and the dogs do need to be under anesthesia to have this done. And it can be done very safely, even for dogs with underlying medical and health issues. But doing a wake cleaning, even without extractions, it's very difficult. When I ask someone, do they brush their dog's teeth? They're like, no, I can't even get the toothbrush in. Well, how are you going to be expecting a veterinarian to get in there with an ultrasonic scaler and, you know, and be able to get under the gum line and be able to, you know, clean everything that needs to be cleaned if we can't even get into the dog's mouth? It's hard enough to do an awake oral exam on a dog in many cases, let alone get in there and clean. And we can cause so much damage to the dog, and they could cause damage to us. And probably one of the big things that really needs to be done when dogs are having dental work done, especially if there's any questionable teeth, is getting x-rays done in the mouth. And just like when humans are having the x-rays done, there's a little plate that they put in our mouth. Well, we use a similar thing like that for dogs. And if they were to bite into it, I think that they cost about $8,000 a piece, maybe a little bit more than that. And if the dog just bites it, you're out that kind of money. So we can't get radiographs. We can't clean effectively. We can't treat effectively. So, working with a veterinarian that's willing to do all the pre-anesthetic workup and have your dog on a safe anesthetic procedure where they're on fluids, they're on monitors for blood pressure, temperature, oxygen levels. They've got someone watching the anesthesia. It can be done very, very safely. So I really encourage you to do that.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you for calling. You can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Let's turn to Rich and Merrill next. Hi, Rich.
Hello, Larry. Dr. Sawcheck. I have a 2-year-old female blue heeler. She's a great pet. She's a little crazy around the edges. She barks in 4 languages. She's very active, and she eats a lot of grass, a lot of vegetables, and she'll go out on a blackberry picking expedition. Now she's looking at raspberries. And I give her a regular ration of a full bowl of dry food every day. Should I be concerned about this vegetarian diet?
Not at all, especially if you're keeping her on a well-balanced diet. There's a lot of dogs that eat grass just because they like a salad now and then. It's not that they have a gastrointestinal upset. They may vomit if they're eating grass that is really coarse or they eat too much of it. But for many dogs, they just like to eat it. And it sounds like your dog is just one of those grazers that is, and this is true for all dogs, they're omnivores. They're not strict carnivores. They like to eat these things. And so just making sure that what your dog is eating is safe for them. Blackberries, raspberries, absolutely no trouble. Grapes, on the other hand, very toxic for dogs. So you want to stay away from things like that.
Okay.
Yeah, it can be a problem if you've got wild grapes or grapevines in your yard, because that can have dogs can go into kidney failure by ingesting grapes. So
I did not know that.
Yes, yeah. Grapes and raisins. Yep.
Is there a website where you can go to look at those veggies or fruits that are
toxic?
Yeah,
the Animal Poison Control Center would be the place to go. And they would have like all the different toxic foods and things like that listed on there.
Yeah.
Well, she just yesterday she just went on in the garden and picked her own tomato.
I used to have a Springer Spaniel that would stand on her back legs and pick apples out of the tree, and that was, she, you know, would play with them for a while and then just sit down and eat them, core and all. So yeah,
she's been eating shell corn and apples.
Yeah. And you got to be careful. There's certain things, like we've had dogs get into compost piles and eat things like corn cobs, and they are very non-digestible and act as a gastrointestinal obstruction agent. So you need to make sure if your dog is one of these indiscriminate eaters that you keep certain things away from them and your compost piles and things like that covered up so that they're not getting into anything as a problem. Yeah.
Good luck, Rich. Thanks.
Thank you very much.
On to Brenda in Phillips, Wisconsin. Hi, Brenda.
Morning. I have a question. I have 2 dogs that have seizures and are on phenobarbital, and they're starving all the time. We try to limit their food when they get their phenobarbital and stuff like that, but I have a Bichla, and he's gaining weight pretty quickly, so...
Yeah, that's a problem when we've got dogs that are on like some of the anticonvulsants, other on steroids for some reason. It can sometimes really mess with their mind and make them think that they're hungry and they want to eat, but you have to be the dog's brains. And so it may mean coming up with ways of bulking up the dog's food by maybe instead of feeding them dog treats, you know, when they're mooching and begging, you can give them some frozen green beans or little baby carrots or something. But even that, if they're giving too many of them, can still be caloric. It's not that they're calorie free. But instead of having this dog saying, I'm hungry, feed me, when they're begging you to do that, say, let's go for a walk instead. So that way you both benefit. You get exercise. The dog gets exercise, gets mental stimulation, is away from the food bowl, and is going to come home and be tired and not be bugging you to eat. So just kind of changed what the way you're dealing with them. But it does mean that, you know, you have to be the dog's brains in this case. Yeah.
We have a regular homemade diet that we're feeding them along with some Nutrisource and stuff like that, just trying to... and space the meals out and stuff like that, but I was hoping for a quick fix. Like, it's not.
There isn't. And unfortunately, it's really hard when people are doing homemade diets for us to be able to come up with, unless it's a strict recipe that has been formulated by a veterinary nutritionist where we know so many ounces of this homemade diet gives you so many calories. It's very difficult for us to come up with the caloric amounts that are in those foods, because you may vary what you put in it. It could be, you know, 80% ground beef. It may be 75%, and that change in the fat level is going to change the calories. There's, you know, so it can really be a problem. And so for weight loss, I usually recommend going with a commercial diet or a formulated recipe if you want to go with homemade, so we know exactly how many calories that dog's getting every single day.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, thanks, Brenda. Appreciate the call. And Evie in Bristol, your turn. Hi, Evie.
Hi. Yes, I have a female Great Dane that I got from rescue. She's 2 years old. She apparently had puppies when she was way too young. The rescue did, you know, they fixed her and everything, but she has swelling around her mammary glands. And now the rescue is telling me it's not to worry about it. Everything is fine. There's swelling, but there's also lumps in there.
Huh.
Now my vet is telling me it might be a good idea to take a look at that because it could turn cancerous.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know.
Mm-hmm.
And so I don't know what to do.
Yeah, well, after a dog has nursed a litter of puppies, they tend to have more mammary development, and that may or may not bounce back. And so sometimes they still kind of have some sagginess there that could be cosmetically unappealing to owners. So that could be part of it. But the tissue itself should be soft and not, you know, you shouldn't palpate any lumps or bumps in it. When dogs are spayed after they've had a couple of heat cycles, that really the damage has already been done hormonally to their breast tissue, and they have a fairly good chance of developing breast cancer down the road. And so I teach owners how to do breast exams, even on spayed dogs that have been spayed after they've had a couple of heat cycles, so that you can monitor throughout the dog's life, are you going to be developing breast cancer, and can we get on top of it earlier so that we can get that breast tissue off of there, do a mastectomy, either one affected gland or multiple glands if we need to. So the problem with getting a diagnosis is that we can do needle biopsies where we put a little needle into some of these lumps, aspirate some of the cells out. But many dogs' mammary tumors are what are called mixed mammary tumors, meaning some of the tissue is very benign looking, and right next door could be cells that are very malignant. And so when we get a sample that comes back as, yes, these are abnormal mammary cells, but they're not showing evidence of malignancy, we still can't tell whether this is a malignant mammary tumor or not without taking it off and looking at the whole thing histologically. So I'd go by your veterinarian's recommendations rather than what the rescue group is telling you, because, you know, your veterinarian's the one with the degree, and I don't know what who the rescue group is working with, but you're living with the dog now and you're the dog's advocate, so trust your veterinarian.
Yeah. All right. Very good. Because he did say exactly what you said about that it was kind of iffy to biopsy. So
yeah.
Great.
All right. Thank you, Abby.
Good luck.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. And we had Fran in Delafield with an older pit bull retriever mix. She gets glucosamine, but sometimes seems stiff and in pain in one hip. Can she safely give her any over-the-counter meds? She weighs about 55 pounds.
Well, that depends on what over-the-counter meds you mean, because there are many over-the-counter meds for people that are anti-inflammatories that can be very toxic for dogs. And just the other day, I was in one of our local pet stores, and they sell dog aspirin over-the-counter. And it just makes the hair on my neck stand up, because aspirin in dogs, although you can use it, it's the toxic dose is very close to the therapeutic dose. It can cause gastric ulcers so easily in these dogs. And even just a single dose, when they've gone in and looked at these dogs and scoped them, they found gastric ulceration. So don't use aspirin, even though that's available over the counter and it says okay for dogs because you can buy it at the pet store. That may not be appropriate. Things that you may want to be looking at is, we've had better success when people also have their dogs on a fish oil supplement. And we usually use it at about 100 milligrams per kilogram, which is going to end up being about 200 milligrams or 50 milligrams per pound, I should say. I was doing the math backwards. And you can buy over-the-counter fish oil capsules for people, and you just kind of round to the closest level. I usually start at a lower level than what is recommended and gradually work up because of the risk of causing diarrhea and things. You may want to talk to your veterinarian about a joint-specific diet that is going to be supplemented with all of this as well. And also looking at where your glucosamine, chondroitin sulfate is coming from. There are several companies out there that we as veterinarians veterinarians recognizes what you get is what's in the bottle, what's on the label is, you know, you can trust them. There are a lot of nutraceuticals out there where you may not be getting what you're actually thinking you're giving to your dog. So staying with some of the more reputable companies and going by one that your veterinarian recommends would be what I would recommend. And my preference is a company called Nutramax, and there's another company that it's called Glycoflex, and they make Glycoflex 3 is another one that I like. So there's several out there, but use the one that your veterinarian is most comfortable with.
Anne in Elm Grove, thank you for calling. Hello.
Well, thank you for taking my call. Here's my question. I have a 3-year-old male Golden who is just such a sweet dog. We spend a lot of time training. We're working on canine good citizenship, and I've done some rally work with him. So we're constantly, well, not constantly, but a few times a day, we're doing some training exercises. And as you know, Goldens are food motivated. Mm-hmm. And so I do use little tiny treats as rewards. Mm-hmm. And because he's such a sweet dog, it's also fun to just give him treats once in a while. Dr. Sandy, your homemade Frosty Paw recipe was a huge success with my dog. So
good.
Here's my question. In the morning and at night when I'm giving him his regular meals, should I be kind of pulling back on the amount because he's going to get treats during the day? I mean, I do that sometimes, and then I worry that he didn't get enough treats during the day to make up for the amount of food I withheld at mealtime.
Mm-hmm. And some dogs are very just food motivated that you can even use the regular kibble as treats because it's coming from your hand.
Yeah,
and then, you know, there are some dog foods on the market that are kind of in a log shape. They look like a giant salami where you know how many calories are in like a 1-inch slice of that, and you mm-hmm. can take that and say, okay, this is how many calories extra on top of the food that you're using, so you can cut back on the dry food, but realize that you're using a balanced diet that is just in a different form that your dog is going to think is just wonderful. Natural Balance makes these log type things, and there's a couple of other companies that do it as well. And you can chop that up into little tiny matchstick pieces and know exactly kind of where the calories are coming from. I've had people mm-hmm. use fat-free hot dogs, and again, those are the calories are right on there per hot dog, how much is in there, and cut that up into little dime-sized slices, and that way your dog's getting something that's a little higher, you know, a little protein and fat. If they've got a sensitive stomach, obviously that would be something you'd probably want to avoid using, but mm-hmm. that all has to be accounted for when you're doing your caloric calculations for your dog. But there's ways of doing it and yet keeping the diet balanced.
All right, so just continue to be mindful of how many treats and the calories.
And make that be part of, you know, actually when you're doing your calorie count, make sure that's part, you're including the calories and the treats that you're using every day.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome.
Thanks a lot for calling. And she mentioned your Frosty Paw recipe.
Yeah.
And people are going to say, well, I didn't hear that the last time or whatever.
Yeah, well, I kind of mix it up a little bit for my dogs, and I'll do a mashed banana and fat-free Greek yogurt and mix it up. Sometimes I'll add a little peanut butter to it. Make sure you're not using peanut butter that has xylitol in it, which is becoming very popular on the grocery shelves because that's quite toxic for dogs. And just kind of make this liquid mess and pour it into little paper cups and let it freeze and pop it out, and away you go. Your dog's got a little low-fat ice cream treat that takes them a long time to eat. But again, you've got to know if your dog's overweight, you've got to include the calories that are in that compared to, you know, you don't want to have them taking that over their balanced food.
Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the UW School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller here on the Ideas Network. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, taking a look at your pet's health. And Jackie in Appleton has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Jackie.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a 16-year-old terry poo. And he has always weighed between 9 and 10 pounds. And he started having a little bit of an incontinence problem at night. It generally didn't happen until maybe 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. So we took him to the vet.
And he put him on medication for it and did a blood test and said he had high protein levels. Well, the dry dog food that he gave for him to eat, he refuses to eat. The stew meat, he don't eat unless I put something with it. I've tried rice, I've tried pasta, and I finally ended up putting some boiled turkey in with it and mixing it in with the low protein whatever. And in order to get him to take his pills, we ended up putting it, wrapping it in a piece of liver sausage. How much more damage am I doing? Putting that turkey in with this food and wrapping his pills. I mean, the only other way we could get his pills down him is to straddle him and force his mouth open. And, of course, that makes him so angry.
Yeah.
And we don't know what to do with this little guy.
So I'm a little confused about the diagnosis. Was he diagnosed with having kidney disease and needs to be on a low-protein diet? Or
They gave him a pill that the vet said tastes like garlic and he may not like it. And okay. I cut that into quarters.
Okay. And what is that? And what is that for? Do you know?
I believe that was for the incontinence.
Okay.
So then before we left that appointment, he said, let me do a blood test.
Okay.
So he did a blood test and said that his protein levels were too high and that he needed to be put on a low-protein diet.
Okay, but one of the few things that low-protein diets are, when we have a dog that needs to be on a low-protein diet, it's typically a dog with kidney disease is probably the number one thing, which is very common in small-breed older dogs. And often these dogs will be drinking more and urinating more, which will cause them to sometimes have accidents in the middle of the night or be incontinent if their bladder sphincter is a little on the weak side. They just, you know, are going to dribble urine out. So I'm wondering if your dog has been put on, I'd really have to see your dog's medical records to be able to answer your question and be able to tell you, is it safe for you to be using things like Lunchmeat and Braunschweiger and things like that to get pills in? Because if he needs to be on a low protein diet because his blood urea nitrogen and his creatinine were too high and he's in kidney failure, yes, you may be causing him more problems. I'm not sure what the drug is that your veterinarian is using. If it is one that's called phenylpropanolamine, it sometimes goes by the brand name of Proen. That may be an inappropriate drug to use for your dog because many dogs that have kidney failure are also hypertensive, and that drug can potentiate hypertension, actually make high blood pressure worse, which can worsen the kidney disease. So I think that it's time you need to go back and get like a better thorough evaluation or explanation from your veterinarian so that then we can come up with a plan to how to medicate your dog and get medication in that and maybe even get them on an appropriate medication because I'm trying to piece this together and it sounds like your dog, if they need to be on a low protein diet, probably has kidney disease, and that's what I'm really, really concerned about. And so give your vet a call this afternoon and just say, hey, I'm having all this trouble. Please explain to me exactly what the diagnosis is and what's going on.
Mm-hmm. There we go. Good luck, and thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And David and Slinger, we'll turn to you next. Hi, David.
Hello. I'll get to the point, I think. I have a 2-year-old mini Labradoodle, doesn't look like it so much, but about 30 pounds or so. But his main problem is anxiety. He's always been very anxious. When you take him out at night, he bounces around and barks to try to scare everything away until he feels it's safe. If there's somebody that's anxious around him, he starts panting and almost has panic attacks. In fact, one point was out of a seizure. But just having a lot of trouble with anxiety. We try to walk him a lot to wear him down. But any suggestions for an anxious dog?
Have you worked with a behaviorist, an applied animal behaviorist? Have you brought this up with your veterinarian?
We have with the vet, but I guess we haven't really gone into it a great deal.
Okay.
You know, and of course people say use lavender oil, but that didn't do anything.
Well, there's lots of, like, weird and wonderful things that may help or may not help. And, you know, some of the herbal things, like you just mentioned, lavender oil. But you have to be careful that the dog isn't licking it or anything like that, or it's not irritating to their skin. There's a product on the market called Dog Appeasement Pheromone, which goes by the name DAP, and it comes in a collar form or a spray that, again, is it going to help the dog? Maybe. Is it going to hurt? No. I think the big thing is we need to figure out what is the trigger for your dog's anxiety and either work on desensitizing them to that, work on developing some relaxation exercises that you can use to get mm-hmm. that dog back into a comfortable state. It may mean that your dog needs to be on prescription medication. Sometimes we use things in like the tricyclic antidepressant range. We'll sometimes use serotonin reuptake inhibitors like fluoxetine or Prozac. Mm-hmm. So there's a number of drugs like that we use. We use trazodone as another very common one. So there are prescription drugs that can be used and safely for most dogs, but we usually want to make sure that they have no underlying health problems. And so we usually get some blood work done before we put them on any of those medications. But I think that would be something to go back to your veterinarian about and say, here's what we're dealing with. Is there anything that we can do? But remember, there's no medication that is going to cure your dog. You're really looking at the medication may help you with training your dog to be relaxed in those situations. And that's where you really need the help of somebody that can work one-on-one with you to be able to observe your dog and give you all the suggestions that you need.
Well, we've been reluctant to use the invisible fence, thinking that would make him even more nervous.
It very well could, and it's not suitable for every dog, especially if there are dogs that are one-time learners. They go outside, they stand in the grass, and they hear the tone, and then they get zapped. They may just say, hey, standing on grass is evil. I can't go out there. And the worst-case scenario I ever had was a golden retriever that was a one-time learner, very nervous dog. They put in an invisible fence without checking with anybody, and the dog got zapped once. The only way they could get that dog out of the house was to go out through the attached garage, put the dog in the car, back the car out of the driveway, onto the street, and walk the dog on the street. And it took months to get that dog comfortable with even putting a foot on the grass again after just that one episode of being zapped. So, so I'd be hesitant to use it until you get to the bottom of this and you've got, you know, his underlying issue a little bit better under control.
All right. Good luck. Thank you so much for calling. And Barbara in Milwaukee, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi, thank you. I have a dog who has herniated spine disc in his neck, and his right front leg started turning inward when he walked. Well, now it's gotten more severe, and I found these splints for disabled dogs, and I was wondering if putting one of those on would be good for him.
Is this a splint for his leg?
So it's a leg splint that goes, it's got like a cushion and plastic that curves for the paw to rest on it and a little piece of rubber on the pad where the pad would be.
Yeah, you have to be, you have to be really careful with using splints in dogs. They cannot tell us really when there's an issue with it's uncomfortable for them, it's rubbing abnormally, it has to be fitted appropriately. And so just buying one over the counter without having, you know, one custom made for your dog may be problematic. I'd be thinking that it would be more worthwhile to pursue why your dog is having this leg problem. If it is a neurologic problem where you've got nerve compression, then, you know, is your dog a surgical candidate to...
No, he's not, because he has syringomyelia and they won't operate.
Oh, so he's got some other underlying neurologic problems.
I've had him to Madison, Dr. Ryland sees him.
Oh, okay.
And he has a heart murmur also, and he's
12, so yeah. They don't
want to
operate.
Yeah, and so I think, you know, anything, like sometimes some of the, like, walking carts that they make for dogs that may be supportive, there's a harness that's available that's called the Help 'em Up harness you may find is helpful when you're taking your dog out to help support some of that weight on that front leg. And, you know, really consider some physical therapy as well so that we don't lose muscle mass in that leg as the nerves start to degenerate. And that way your dog will be more mobile longer.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Yeah, thanks for calling. Appreciate your call. Stephen Tomahawk, hello.
Good morning. I just had a comment on people buying their dogs. Like when you buy a Labradoodle, that is actually a hunting dog, isn't it?
Well, it's a Labradoodle is a cross between a Labrador Retriever and a Poodle. And depending on the genetics of it, we are now seeing miniature Golden Doodles where the dad is a miniature Poodle and mom is a Golden or a Labrador. So they are a mixed breed dog, and they, whether they have hunting skills or not, is all genetically dependent. And genes are one of those things where you never can determine what the dog's going to get. So, it's possible that they may like hunting, but I haven't seen too many of them that really enjoy it.
Oh. Isn't that why that they would bark, though, is because they're mixed with a hunting dog?
Again, barking is one of those things where it may be breed-related, but it could be just a learned behavior that the dog has as well. I think it's really hard to generalize about any dog that is a cross between two dogs because genetics is a crapshoot.
Yeah. But I would say that getting your dog out and getting that dog exercise.
Oh, you still need to do that, obviously. It may just not be out in the field with you with a gun, but the dog may love to run in a field and make sure you've got them on flea and tick control and all that this time of the year. But, yeah, you got to find the right exercise for your dog.
And we had, here's a quick one, a listener emailed to ask your thoughts on cannabis biscuits for noise phobia.
Well, you can buy them now. They ship them from California, and it's a cannabinoid oil, and so it's like just the... it's legal to be able to buy them. I had a client give me a bag, and I tried them on my dogs, and it did nothing. So I don't know.
Didn't work for your dogs.
Didn't work for my dogs, and I wasn't about to try one of those dog biscuits either. But supposedly there's no psychoactive medication in it. It's just to help them with pain and so on.
And we'll be back after the news. Taking a look at your pet's health today with Dr. Sandy Sawchuk from the University of Wisconsin School of Veterinary Medicine. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today. If you have a question about your pet's health, I hope you'll join us. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Love to hear from you. And Sandy, we've got some great photos up on our Facebook page, and a note from Megan who says that her cat Nugget has been overweight and looks overweight too.
Yeah, I would guess that she's probably an 8 out of 9 or 9 out of 9, so about 30 to 40% over her ideal body weight.
She's 7, weighs 17 pounds, has a history of UTTs?
UTIs. Okay.
UTIs?
Yeah, it's supposed to be urinary tract infections.
Oh, okay. Recently diagnosed with idiopathic cystitis. We've been giving her a quarter cup of food, and I got to scroll down here, twice a day of prescription Purina.
Yeah, there's certain diets that we use for kitties that have bladder issues, and so they're using one brand, the Purina, and it's and then they're also using a wet formula as well. If the cat is having trouble with gaining weight on things or not handling the food appropriately, doesn't like the food, there are other therapeutic diets out there. And food companies are starting to address the fact that we have cats sometimes with more than one disease condition. We can have that overweight cat that needs to lose weight, as well as the cat that may need to, be on a kidney diet, or not a kidney, a bladder-specific diet. And so they're now coming out with combination diets. And I believe Science Diet has now come out with a metabolic diet as well as one for handling bladder conditions as well. And so that might be something to be looking at. But even with that, you have to figure out, rather than just a quarter cup and a quarter cup and here's the amount of canned and think that that's the right volume for the cat, you need to do caloric calculations. And I just very quickly sat down when I saw the picture of this cat and said, okay, she's about 30 to 40% over her ideal body weight. And I did the little bit of math. And so she ends up being, again, with me just doing the math in my head, needing about 180 calories a day, which is not very much.
No.
When you consider that many of those therapeutic diets can have upwards around 350, 400 calories, and she's getting a half a cup as well as canned food. So she's probably getting more calories than she needs, which is not going to be helping her with, you know, her bladder issues and things. We want her to be comfortable going to the litter box and urinating on a regular basis.
Drew on Facebook says his dogs are always too skinny. He's had them checked for parasites. He's tried different foods. He wants them to eat more.
Yeah, there are some dogs that just they don't live to eat. You know, they just, you know, eat to, you know, because they have to. And I would bet, though, that if Drew brought those dogs in to see me, I would probably think that they were normal, okay? Because people see these dogs that have a 4 out of 9 body condition score, which at the beginning of the show I mentioned is normal. That is like the 4 to 5 is what we consider normal. That, you know, seeing those ribs, having a little bit of a waist, that is what we want for these dogs. So it may mean that he's just doing a really good job of keeping these dogs exercised and that he's lucky and that he has dogs that are not super food motivated. So I would really doubt that they're too skinny. He's probably just got the perception that a little bit fatter is the way they're supposed to be.
John in Three Lakes, thanks for calling. Hello.
Good morning. I have a yellow lab, 12 and a half years old, with laryngeal paralysis, and has also been diagnosed with old dog syndrome. We don't know whether it was a stroke or the old dog syndrome, but she has recently started to vomit rather uncontrollably. Occasionally it will be a clear mucusy type thing with little bits of food. And other times it'll be a very green, bilious-looking vomit. And we've tried softening her food. We've tried feeding her numerous times throughout the day. That doesn't seem to help. We took her to the vet. They gave her some medication, I believe it's an anti-nausea or, motion sickness, which took care of it quite nicely, but I don't know if we want to keep her on that. Any suggestions?
Well, you're dealing with two common problems in older dogs. The first you mentioned is laryngeal paralysis, where the vocal cords, which normally move back and forth as the dog is barking and breathing, are just hanging there flapping in the breeze, which is going to cause a couple of problems for the dog. One of them is that they are not able to close off their airway, and so they're able to inhale food particles or vomit if they happen to regurgitate or vomit. And so it can really put them at risk for developing aspiration pneumonia, where stuff goes down the windpipe that shouldn't be there. And then on top of that, you've got this dog with old dog vestibular disease. I assume that's what you meant. And what that syndrome is where we don't really know what causes it, but they have an acute onset of losing their balance. And it may be on one side, it may be on both sides. Typically, it's one side. So the dog feels like they're on the tilt-a-whirl. They have a head tilt. Their eyes are flicking and drifting. They can be very nauseous with this. And they have to often stay on anti-nausea medication until they get better. And for the majority of these dogs, a matter of a few days to maybe a few weeks, they are often better. I usually expect that within a week they should be really looking much better. If they're not, then we start thinking that could this be something other than this condition that just affects the balance apparatus? Do we have a brain tumor or something affecting the balance apparatus centrally in the brain that could be presenting with the same type of symptoms as you would see in a dog with just the peripheral vestibular system being affected? So I'd keep her on the anti-nausea medication if it helped, because we don't want your dog vomiting and inhaling it. And so we've got this double double whammy with that poor larynx not working correctly. So I think keeping her on the antiemetics would be helpful.
There we go. Good luck. Thank you for calling. Lisa in La Crosse, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hi. I have a cat who's had an ear infection for a long time, and last fall it was treated and it got cleared up, and then it came back again. And so they were treating it again, and I went to a different vet, and she's treating it again. And she said it's the possibility that it stems from his diet, so that he might have an allergy.
Mm-hmm.
Is this possible?
It's possible. I mean, anytime we have recurrent ear infections, we always want to make sure that there isn't something affecting that particular ear canal that could be predisposing them to it. Does your cat have a polyp or a small tumor in the ear? Do they have a ruptured eardrum with a middle ear infection that just keeps on, you know, brewing and causing problems for the cat? So you treat it, it gets better, and then it comes right back again. And so doing some diagnostics, and depending on the temperament of the cat, sometimes we can just have a look with an otoscope and get in there and have a very good evaluation of what's going on in the ear canal. If the eardrum's intact, obviously we can't say what's going on the other side in the middle ear cavity. I hope that your veterinarian has also done some cytology where they've taken swabs from the ear and actually looked to see is there certain organisms in there like yeast or certain bacteria that may need to be treated with appropriate drugs. We will see with recurrent ear infections, and they've been treated with antibiotics over and over again, sometimes the development of resistant bugs that require totally different antibiotics to be able to get it under control. So sometimes we even have to resort to doing cultures and sensitivities of the material that we get out on the swab to have know what antibiotic we can use. But if your kitty is just experiencing ear canal inflammation, which means that there's no infection there, it's just red and irritated, and they can't find bacteria, they can't find yeast, then I would be looking at, do we have some underlying allergic problem going on? It's more common in dogs to have their skin present, especially with ear inflammation, with allergies. Food allergies only account for, oh boy, a small amount. I'm just going to throw a number out there, like 15% of the allergies that we see. The majority of them are going to be environmental allergens that are like house dusts and pollens and molds and things. But it's always worthwhile because it's easy to diagnose. It just means, especially if you've got, he's the only cat, you put him on a hypoallergenic diet. And by that, I mean a hydrolyzed protein diet that you would get from your veterinarian that the cat's not going to recognize where the ingredients, especially the proteins, come from. Just changing to another brand of food over the counter is not going to be adequate for doing a food trial. You're looking at probably a good 8 to 12 weeks, 2 to 3 months of being on a specialized diet like that where they get nothing but that and water to be able to rule out whether that is the cause of it or not. So if your veterinarian strongly thinks that, then a food trial definitely is in order before you start looking at other environmental allergens.
There we go. Thank you so much. And Connor emailed to say he lives in a small two-bedroom apartment with his friend. They both have cats. Hers about a year old and his is about 15 weeks old, both Maine Coon. They have little space and only one litter box. And for the past week or so, both have decided to start using the living room floor and the couch instead of the litter box.
Uh-oh.
They've tried changing the litter and retraining them to the litter box location. Any ideas?
Well, this is a real problem. The number of litter boxes that you need for a two-cat household is 3. And so that's something that you always need to, with you've got two cats, you need an extra litter box than cat number. And so that's something to consider when you start adding new cats to your household. And there's got to be other places, under desks, in the bathroom, a corner in the dining room.
There's
someplace.
Two bedrooms.
Yeah, there's two bedrooms. So there's got to be other places that you can put these litter boxes. And if the cat's picking the living room, obviously that would be the place to go as well, as putting a litter box there. You may not like it, but I'd rather have them use the litter box there than using your carpet or your couch. Make sure you're cleaning the spots that they've gone on very well so they're not attracted back there, which means using a good enzymatic cleaner. A couple of my favorites are Urine Off and another one called AIP, Anti-Icky Poo, that you can get online. And so I'd be recommending that you use those. You have to get it into the carpet pad, into the stuffing of your couch. And so you do have to use a lot of it. It's not something you can just spritz on the top and walk away because the odor is going to be down in those lower levels of your upholstery and things. Make sure that the box is big enough. Maine Coon cats are huge cats, and commercial litter boxes, there is not one on the market that is big enough for your average big cat. And so I tell people, if you've got a large cat, go out and get one of these like under the bed storage bins, something like that, that can hold a lot of litter and allow the cat to be able to move around. The litter box needs to be, and you'd size this for the adult cat, 1.5 times the length of the cat from head to butt. So that's how long the litter box needs to be. Make sure it's not a covered box. Most cats hate covered boxes. They put the cover on it for us so that we don't have to see it, smell it, you know, and so we may not keep it as clean as we need to. And make sure you are cleaning it, scooping it at least daily, if not more frequently. And using the correct litter, using a soft, scoopable, sandy litter would be appropriate as well. And I would also be looking at, is there some underlying medical reason that's triggering this? Are the cats stressed? Do you have some type of a bladder issue or something that's causing the cat to not use the litter box? So we always want to get that off the table as well. So it may mean a visit to the veterinarian to have that taken care of. But I think definitely addressing the management. And if you've got a two-bedroom apartment, you've definitely have room for 3 litter boxes. Yeah.
I was thinking about the litter box. I have one of these long, at your suggestion, one of these long litter boxes. And I walked by the other day and they were both using it at the same time.
There you go. You know, and I've had some people use like the kiddie swimming pools. That works really well. Some people have used the under the like washing machine trays that you can buy that are for catching drips from washing machines. Obviously, you can't put a lot of litter in them because the lip is only about an inch or two tall, but you can pile up the litter in the middle. And so for cats with arthritis or something, it's kind of zero entry. The cement storage mixing bins work great for litter boxes, and they're very inexpensive at one of the home improvement stores.
Dawn in Broadhead, thank you for calling. Hello.
Hello. We have a Jack Russell Beagle mix that is 9 years old. This summer, she's developed warts, especially on her leg and her foot. We took her to the vet, and he said that that's just the normal aging thing. But she's licking and licking them as if they are bothering her. Mm-hmm. Is there something that we can do for her?
Get them removed.
Yeah.
I would get them removed. First of all, warts as a warts is are caused by a virus, and they can be on the skin. They're often in the mouth. They have a very unique look. They kind of look like little sea anemones. For most of the things that we see in dogs are usually what are called sebaceous adenomas, which are tumors of the sebaceous glands. And so they can be a little greasy. They can get infected. They can itch. They may bother the dog. And so often we're looking at removing them. If they're depending on, how big they are, sometimes we can do it with cryotherapy. If you've ever had any benign skin masses and gone to the dermatologist, they zap them with a cryo unit. And we do that at the vet school. And many veterinarians have cryotherapy units that can freeze those little things. But once those are done, they're going to be licking at them even more. So you may have to put something like an e-collar on while you're waiting for them to regress. And remember, even with cryotherapy, they may need to have multiple treatments to get them gone. Sometimes it's just easier to have them removed surgically and have a couple of sutures or staples put in, an e-collar on for 10 days, and just get rid of them. If they're not bothering the dog, they're mainly cosmetic. But they could also be some other types of tumors that can be itchy as well. Things like mast cell tumors are very much, they can look alike, basal cell tumors. And so if you get them off, I do strongly encourage you to either save them in formalin so you can submit them if they regrow, or have them submitted for histopathology so you know exactly what they are.
There we go. Thank you again for calling, Dawn. Dick in Northland, or Heartland, excuse me. It's your turn. Hi.
Hi.
What can we do for you?
Well, I've got a four-year-old dachshund who is the sweetest thing in the world, but he has a bad body odor. Is there anything I can do for that?
Well, we have to determine where that body odor is coming from. And so it's like having a head-to-toe physical exam. Some of the hot spots for bad smells are obviously the mouth. Being a small breed dog, they're very prone to periodontal disease. And especially if you've got a dog that's licking themselves, they may be spreading that horrible smelly saliva all over their body. And so that's where the odor may be coming from. We'll also see dogs with chronic ear infections really stinking as well. And that could be one of the spots. Impacted anal glands that are periodically leaking could be a problem. But one of the things that I see fairly commonly in dachshunds is yeast infections over their body, and they end up smelling like an old dirty tennis shoe. I don't know if that's what the smell is like, but there's a very unique smell to this, and they tend to occur in like their armpits and their groin where they have skin on skin contact, and you may have like kind of a shiny skin, or there may be kind of a greasy exudate on it. The way we get a diagnosis is by doing some cytology, taking a slide and either pushing it up against the skin and having a look at it after it's stained, or using some scotch tape and collecting some of the skin and cells and organisms that are there. And if that's what we're finding, the typical reason why we see secondary yeast infections in dogs is because they have allergies. So we may have to address the allergies. Sometimes it's a matter of using medicated shampoos and things to get it under control. But I think that's the first step is just going on the hunt for where is the smell coming from. But I also see dogs that are just smelly because their bedding never gets washed. I mean, we wash our sheets all the time, but our dog beds sometimes. People get a bed when they're a puppy and they never think about washing it because it doesn't look dirty. But boy, you've got dead skin cells there and anything that the dog is drug in, and they're just transferring that back up to their body again every time they lay in it. So make sure that you are washing your dog's bedding frequently to keep them from re-inoculating themselves with their normal smells.
There we go. Thank you again for calling. And Nina in Friendship, hello.
Oh, hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Dr. Sandy, I have a 14-year-old female lab retriever mix, and she's been in generally very good health. Just a couple weeks ago, she started having a little incontinence. And I know earlier in the show, you mentioned a drug named Proin, and that is what she's on. She's been on it for 2 weeks. 50 milligrams twice a day, every 12 hours. And it seems it's working. But my question, I was concerned about the hypertension. I noticed that she is panting a little bit more, but she also has arthritis.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes when she, like, walks out of the house, she falls, or we're making a ramp for her now. So my question was, is there an alternative for the Proin, or do you think?
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, if I have a 14-year-old, a newly incontinent dog coming in, especially a senior citizen, young dog, she was 2 years old, a spayed female, started to become incontinent, I'd do a urine sample to make sure that she doesn't have a urinary tract infection, and I'd probably not have any concerns about starting her on something like Proin, because it's rare to see young dogs developing hypertension. They don't just get hypertension like we do, where you can be healthy, but hypertensive. Dogs usually have to have some underlying cause, like kidney disease, Cushing's disease, which is overactive adrenal glands. And so when I get an older dog in that develops incontinence, the first thing that goes off in my head is, why? Is this dog making more urine? And so I'd be doing some blood work and a urinalysis to see, is there an underlying thing that we can get under control, such as treating Cushing's disease or managing her kidney disease? I would never start a 14-year-old dog on Proin without checking blood pressure, because there's so many reasons why they can be hypertensive. And if they are on the medication before, if they're not hypertensive, intensive. We start them on it. I check blood pressure after they've been on it for a couple of weeks to make sure that it's normal. But the other two drugs that we can use if your dog is experiencing hypertension are estrogen-like drugs. There's one licensed for dogs called Incurin that's used daily. It's very safe. And one that has to be formulated called DES, or diethylstilbestrol, that your vet would have to get through probably an outside pharmacy.
And with that, we're out of time. Thanks, Nina, for calling. And Sandy, thank you. You'll be back October 25th.
I will, right at the end of the month.
We will do it all over again. Dr. Sandy Sawchuk, clinical instructor at the UW-Madison School of Veterinary Medicine. She'll be back. We'll do this all over again. Tomorrow at this time, we'll be talking about the public lands in Wisconsin. We have hundreds and hundreds of thousands of acres, and we'll talk about how it's managed. So I hope you can join us for that. In the meantime, thank you for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store here on the Ideas Network.